Ghoulish greetings, everybody. Those tunes are courtesy of the amazing Bobby Mackey, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow.
Now today it's a different place, all the same with a new face, with strange mysteries hanging in the air. People in their sane minds swear they see you today. Are you looking for the love they took away?
Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, whenever you listen and wherever you listen from tiny mountain town to desolate island, the big city, and just everything in between, it is absolutely appreciated. Where will this week's special city shoutouts take us to? And by the way, my apologies, I totally realized that I got so excited about the music, I did not do a city shout-out last time, so my bad on that. But here we go, we're diving right in. Nixu, Denmark, Novo, Moskovsk, Ukraine, Amelia, Ohio, Karump, Nevada, Moberly, Missouri, and Wisdom, Montana. Big shout out to all my musically talented, phenomenal friends who, again, lent me their amazing music for these Rock or Death episodes. Alien Manor. Stick the Landing. And Liar's Handshake. And the shout outs just keep on coming as usual, you guys. Big shout out to my voiceover family, Jerry Cooper as Lee Lunane, and Ronnie Van Zant, Casey Morrow as Wendy Orlean Williams, Thomas James as Captain Walter McCreary, and Sean Curtis as Artemis Pyle. Now last week, part one was released in the Rocker Death series, where I talked all about Dimebag Darrell, Randy Rhoads, Vinnie Paul, Eddie Van Halen, and John Lennon. And this week, we continue with Rocker Deaths Part 2, a whole brand new lineup, and it's all happening right now. Things are about to get loud. Music is a language that doesn't speak in particular words. It speaks in emotions, and if it's in the bones, it's in the bones. Keith Richards. Keith Relf was with the Yardbirds. Then later on, he founded the band Renaissance with his sister. Now sadly, he suffers most of his life from poor health, and this includes things like chronic asthma and emphysema and what have you. So in his short life on Earth, he had a few close calls with death, and this was because of that chronic asthma. When Yardbirds break up in 1968, he jumps right back into the music scene and he forms a band known as Renaissance with his sister Jane. Things are great for a while, but it was kind of more slower paced for him than he would have really enjoyed. He wanted louder, so he leaves the band a few years later in 1974 and he forms the band Armageddon. Former bandmates would include Jimmy Page, who would later become Led Zeppelin, Jeff Beck, and Eric Clapton. So that's pretty badass. Now, May 12th of 1976, Keith, he is at home downstairs in the basement doing what he loves most. He's creating beautiful music when tragedy sadly strikes. He did this countless of times. He was playing his beloved electric guitar. He was doing something routine, but the end result would be anything but. He suffers an electric shock due to the electric guitar being ungrounded. Because he had suffered from horrible asthma, it's thought that's a factor of why he was unable to survive this shock. Now, if this isn't heartbreaking enough, which it is, that's a horrible way to go, this poor young man, you know, suffering health issues his entire life, dying this horrible sudden death, it gets worse, much worse. His sweet, then 8-year-old boy walks down those basement steps, and he is the one to discover his father's lifeless body lying on the ground. Keith Ralph was only 33 years old when he died. Music is the only real religion that is worth devoting your soul to. It is the last remnant of the primal scream, the funeral dirge, and the wedding march. It is the light that keeps me out of the shadows, and it is the reason my immortal soul is not in dire straits. Corey Taylor. Next up is Terry Kaith. He was a founding member of the band Chicago. He was also the lead guitarist and lead vocals for Chicago's earlier stuff. So he sings one of my favorite songs from them, Wishing You Were Here. Such a great freaking song. Terry, he had demons. He was notorious for abusing drugs, and he definitely knew that things had to change. He was not in denial. He wasn't like on some suicide march. He wanted to do better. He had told at least one of his bandmates,
I'm going to get things under control. If I don't, this stuff is going to kill me.
Now, it would not be drugs that would claim his life, however. See, the night prior to Terry's death, he had spent the night talking with Lauder de Oliveira, which, sorry, butcherer of names, Tessa Morrow here. He himself would die on stage performing due to a fatal heart attack in Brazil in 2017. Terry had a great talk with his bandmate the night before he died, and things were looking up for him. He was very excited for the future. He was enthusiastic about the future, if you will. He was super excited because he was this close to completing his very first solo album. Terry, he was over the moon thrilled about this. He was so happy talking about the future that he didn't know that just in a matter of hours, his world would come crashing down and he would cease to exist. One thing that Terry Kaith truly enjoyed doing, besides music, of course, was target practice. He loved playing around and shooting his guns. And look, it's like a cop on the beat. He always had one on him. Always. Many people do this every single day, and they live to see another. But not Chicago's Terry Kaith, not on this particular January day. It's January 23rd, 1978. There's a party going on in Woodland Hills, California, and this band, Alien Manor, my cousin Bryce and his boys, that's where they're from, Woodland Hills. So I thought it would be appropriate to play a little bit of tunage from Alien Manor. Anyways, they are at Don's home. He's Chicago's band technician. Terry, he begins to play with his firearms. He spins the .38 revolver. He puts it to the side of his head and he proceeds to pull the trigger. This would terrify anybody. Like, oh my God, what's going on, right? Don, along with other people, they're concerned. They tell him, hey, cut that shit out, man. Don't do something stupid. Stop messing around, dude. Well, Kaith, he lets it be known, hey, guys, I'm totally just messing around. This gun, look, it's unloaded. He puts the .38 down. He grabs a semi-automatic 9mm pistol, and he says to Don what will prove to be his final last words on Earth, quote, don't worry about it. Look, the clip is not even in it. What do you think I'm gonna do? Blow my brains out? Well, to assure his friend that he's not some suicidal maniac, he shows Don taking out the magazine and shows it to him, saying, look. And it was indeed empty. He then puts the magazine back in. He puts it to his temple, like he did with the .38 just moments earlier. and he pulls the trigger. Well, while the magazine may have been empty, there sadly was a round in the chamber. Terry Kaith has no clue. He should have, but he did not. And he dies instantly. He was 8 days away from turning 32 years old. Lee Lunane, Terry's friend and bandmate, talks about the night that he found out his friend was dead. The trumpet player would say this.
I took a call from our manager who said, Lee, are you sitting down? He told me what happened, but I had to see it for myself. They'd taken Terry's body away, but there was blood everywhere.
Terry Kaith's cause of death is an accidental gunshot wound to the head. Some screamed suicide, but his bandmates and many others jumped to his defense. He was not suicidal. He was trying to better himself, in fact. And he was super stoked about an upcoming solo project that was his very first. Like he had told his bandmate the night before he died, he was excited for the future. Now, yes, I know in certain cases that maybe people were excited for the future and talked about that and what have you, and they still killed themselves. And I get that. But this just, no, not in this case. His bandmates and dear friends were absolutely devastated, right? I mean, anybody would be. They almost disbanded due to the sudden death of their Chicago brother. But they eventually are talked into staying together. Songs by Chicago dedicated to their late friend and band member include, but perhaps not limited to, Alive Again and Feel the Spirit. The surviving members of Chicago describe Terry Kaith as the heart and soul of Chicago, that he, quote, was the musical leader of the band, unquote. Jimi Hendrix would share that Terry Kaith was one of his favorite guitarists and considered the late Chicago member to actually be the best guitarist in the universe, once even saying that he was better than me. At the end of the day, it just comes down to the music. When we're all gone, the music is gonna live on. Kirk Hammett from Metallica. Wendy Orlene Williams was the lead singer for Plumatics. Now people who knew her as a child, they claimed that she was reserved, she was quiet, and actually really shy. But years later, she would really come bursting out of that shy shell, and at just 15 years old, she's arrested for the very first time for sunbathing in the nude. Definitely not shy anymore, my friends. She becomes a stripper, she would do some pornos, she performed in live sex shows. Yeah, I would say she was absolutely not shy anymore. She was actually quite the opposite. Wendy, she was an eccentric babe and way out there. She was dubbed the Queen of Shock Rock. People, they loved her. They adored her. She was fun. She was unique. She wasn't afraid of what others thought. She was definitely out of her shell. Wendy, she would unfortunately deal with depression for a lot of her life. She would attempt suicide several times. The first known attempt on her life is back in 1993 when Wendy manages to grab a hammer. She pulls out a knife and puts it to her chest, and with the hammer, bangs that right into her chest. It hits her breastbone, and she has second thoughts about the suicide, and she reaches out to her longtime boyfriend, Rod Swenson, who thankfully is successful in getting her to the hospital just in the nick of time. In 1997, she would try to die by an overdose. And the following year, in 1998, at 48 years old, she shoots herself, and this time, she is successful. Now, unlike Terry Kaith, this was very intentional. Her loving and caring boyfriend, who had been by her side for well over 20 years, would come home that fateful day to find a box that she had left just for him. This care package, if you will, contained his favorite types of foods, massage balm, seeds to grow in a garden, a number of suicide notes and sealed envelopes, and I cannot fathom what went through this man's head as he is reading these letters, realizing that the love of his life, the woman he had spent well over two decades with, was really gone, wiped off the face of the earth, her being the culprit and the reason why. Unfortunately, sometimes true love is just not enough. Now, he did not walk through the door and come upon her lifeless body. No, the package was there. The notes were there, but she was not in the home. It's like a morbid scavenger hunt, if you will, but he knows exactly what he is looking for, and it's heartbreaking. He's looking for the body of his beloved Wendy. He searches the woods not too far from their home where he discovers her body. Now, she knew that he was going to be the one, probably, to find her, and she did not want to leave that bloody image of her in his head. So what she actually does is she puts a bag over her head before pulling the trigger. In Wendy Orlean Williams' own words, she wrote this:
"I don't believe that people should take their own lives without deep and thoughtful reflection over a considerable period of time. I do believe strongly, however, that the right to do so is one of the most fundamental rights that anyone in a free society should have. For me, much of the world makes no sense. But my feelings about what I am doing ring loud and clear to an inner ear and a place where there is no self, only calm."
Her boyfriend Rod says this about her, quote, "She had this attitude that she'd rather be dead than part of this conformist world," unquote. Truly heartbreaking. Again, just sometimes true love is not enough. Music kept me off the streets and out of trouble and gave me something that was mine that no one could take away from me. Eddie Van Halen. Next up is James Hodges Ellis, but he was better known as Orion. His voice was similar to Elvis Presley, so much so that when Elvis himself died and Orion kept recording songs, this led many people to believe that perhaps Elvis wasn't dead at all. Orion wore a mask. It was pretty much his, like, signature thing. So when he's performing, not only did he sound like the king of rock and roll, but he also had the same body frame as the late singer as well. Besides being a singer and performing all over the place, he also owned a store alongside his either girlfriend, fiance, or ex-wife. Couldn't find out who she exactly was to him. It seemed like everyone was calling her something different. Let's just say it's a woman that was in his life who was running the store with James. And here it is, at the store, where James Hodges Ellis' life comes to an abrupt halt. The day is December 12th of 1998. It's just another regular, ordinary day here at the store. Nothing to write home about. The place is Jimmy's Pawn Shop. Everything's fine. When suddenly a man, later identified as Jeffrey Lee, enters the store, possibly with two other people, and holds James and his lady friend, Elaine Thompson, up. He attempts to rob them, but something happens where the robbery turns into cold-blooded murder. By the end of the so-called robbery, James Hodges Ellis, better known as Orion, and his lady friend Elaine Thompson are brutally murdered, and another employee, a woman named Helen, is severely injured, but thankfully she does survive. The coroner would testify at the murder trial that Ellis died of a gunshot wound to his chest, while Thompson died from a gunshot wound to her face. Thankfully, Helen King recovers, and she's able to testify at the trial. King would give an inside look into what happened that horrific day. She testified that the young man had walked into the pawn shop. He wanted to see some of the wedding rings that they had on display. He let her know that he did not have money on him, but he would be coming back shortly once he was able to muster up the money from his grandma. He then abruptly leaves. King would say that it wasn't too long after he left that he comes back in and he yells, and excuse my language, "What's up, motherfucker?" He then proceeds to pull out his sawed-off shotgun and he shoots Orion, Elaine Thompson, and then Helen King herself. She would later admit at trial that she fell to the floor and she pretended to be dead. The assassin leaves the store, and what Helen King does next most certainly saved her life. She immediately gets up, locks the door to the store, and calls 911. Guess what, you guys? Lee, just like the time before, he leaves and he tries to enter the store for the third time, but decides to leave when he sees that the door had been locked. And there's no denying that he shot these people in cold blood. The surveillance video shows that to the authorities. He admits that he did it, but he claims that the very first shot was a total accident. I call bullshit. This dude had bad intentions from the very beginning. He knew exactly what he was doing. He saw those wedding rings and he saw dollar signs, and greed was in his heart and soul. And because of what he did, two people are dead, and one woman almost lost her life. Rock and roll is a participatory sport. It ain't passive. It ain't TV. Go out there and rock and roll and dance and have fun. Steven Van Zandt from Lynyrd Skynyrd. Lynyrd Skynyrd had just released their brand spanking new album, Street Survivors. Unbeknownst to them, this would be the very last album that would be recorded and released by the original band members. 3 days later, tragedy strikes. The clock is ticking for Ronnie Van Zandt and siblings Cassie and Steve Gaines. Lynyrd Skynyrd was in the early stages of their tour, known as Tour of the Survivors, and it's a haunting name considering what would happen next. They only complete 5 shows of the tour before catastrophe comes a-knockin'. Hello? Anybody there? October 19th, 1977, they perform at the Greenville Memorial Auditorium in South Carolina. They are to perform at the Louisiana State University the very next day. Life on the road, or in their case, life in the sky. October 20th, 1977, 26 people board the doomed Convair CV-240. Everyone is in pretty good spirits. They just had a wonderful show in South Carolina. They're now en route to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where they would perform at the university. They loved doing what they did, playing their music in front of fans and getting to spend time together and go to these amazing new locations. It's the dream. Before they get on the aircraft, Cassie Gaines lets it be known that she's not really comfortable with the band flying in this aircraft. It's several decades old at this point, and it's outdated, and she just really voices her concern to Ronnie. But basically, whatever Ronnie said went, and he assures her that everything is going to be okay. And he told her,
"If it's your time to go, it's your time to go."
During the flight, Ronnie Van Zandt, he's pretty tired. He's pooped out. And so he grabs a pillow, he finds a spot on the floor, and he lays down and he passes out. Many of the others pass the time by either playing cards or chatting amongst themselves. Captain Walter McCreary, he communicates with the flight tower that they have 5 hours worth of fuel on the plane. So imagine everybody's surprise when barely 2.5 hours go by, and he is letting it be known that,
"We're low on fuel, and we're just about out of it."
I mean, excuse me, but what the actual fuck? How can they have miscalculated the fuel like that? People's lives now are at stake. I mean, come on, things happen, mistakes happen, plane crashes happen. But when a plane crashes and it is pilot error, it's definitely insult to injury for the people who now have to bury their loved ones and the people that lost their lives. Just like when Andrew A. Cock was to blame for the deaths of Youngblood and Randy Rhoads. Just a crying shame. When it was known that they were out of fuel and would be attempting to crash land, Artemis Pyle besides being the drummer, was also a pilot, and he was giving advice to everyone about what they needed to do to prepare themselves for this emergency crash landing. He shared that Van Sant began shaking his hand as if he was saying goodbye to everybody, like he knew, this is it, this is the end, like he just told Cassie Gaines,
"If it's your time to go, it's your time to go."
Billy Powell, he was the keyboardist, and he would say this when it came to the crash, quote, "I remember we started clipping those pine trees. It felt like being rolled down a hill in the garbage can. We're being hit by about 100 baseball bats at the very same time." 26 people may have boarded the plane, but because of the horrible crash, 6 people would not live to get off that plane. The 6th fatalities were Ronnie Van Sant, the lead singer, Steve Gaines, the guitarist and backing vocalist, and his older sister by 1 year, Cassie Gaines, who was a backup singer. And remember, she was also the one who voiced the concern of the safety of this aircraft before they boarded. Dean Kilpatrick was the assistant road manager. He also died. And then we have Captain Walter McCreary and First Officer William John Gray. All 6 people who died were killed on impact. The surviving members in the crash were Alan Collins, Billy Powell, Artemis Pyle, Gary Rosington, and Leon Wilkerson. So they basically run out of fuel. When this was realized, they try to get to the closest airport possible, which was 10 miles away from the crash site. They slam right into this huge tree, and the Convair CV-240, it's completely and utterly destroyed. The surviving members may have lived to see another day, but they suffered severe injuries. The keyboardist, Billy Powell's nose, is almost torn completely off. He suffers a fatal heart attack in his Florida home in 2009. The bassist, Leon Wilkerson, he suffers a double fracture to his left leg, a double compound fracture to his left arm, a broken rib that punctured his left lung, 5 additional broken ribs, 15 of his teeth were knocked clear out, and he suffers severe facial damage. Wilkerson rejoins the reformed band, but sadly, he suffered from lung disease and chronic liver, and he unfortunately dies in his sleep at age 49. Guitarist Gary Rosington, he was the last surviving founding member of Lynyrd Skynyrd, who was still in the band at the time of his death in March of 2023. His injuries, like the others, were brutal. The guitarist broke both his arms, both of his legs, both of his ankles, both of his wrists, and his pelvis. He thankfully and miraculously, he recovers and he's able to play again. He shared that as the plane began hitting trees, the sounds just got louder and louder and louder until he loses consciousness. And when he finally does wake up, which lucky he did, he finds that the plane's door had landed right on top of him. He did not know who, if anyone, had survived. And who, if anyone, had died. Several days later, after the crash, he is still in the hospital, and his wife tells him that Van Sant and the Gaines siblings and Kilpatrick, the tour manager, all dead. The guitarist, Alan Collins, he breaks 2 vertebrae in his neck, and his right arm was badly damaged. They wanted to amputate it, actually, but he refused. Years later, in 1986, he is involved in a horrific car accident. The end result? His girlfriend dies, and he finds himself paralyzed from the waist down. He pleads no contest to vehicular manslaughter and driving under the influence of alcohol. Now, due to the deaths of Ronnie Van Sant and Steve and Cassie Gaines, Lynyrd Skynyrd comes to a halt. But around 10 years later, in 1987, they reform the band with the help of Ronnie's brother, Johnny Van Sant, who takes over lead vocals, and the surviving members of the original Lynyrd Skynyrd. So that's pretty cool. This includes the now paralyzed Alan Collins, but he's unable to play, and he would become the musical director. One of the things included in his plea bargain from the crash, one of the terms was is that he had to go on stage every single one of their concerts and talk to the crowd, letting them know exactly why he was unable to perform and the dangers of drinking and driving. He sadly dies a few short years later in 1990 due to complications from his paralysis. Artemis Pyle, the drummer, He breaks several of his ribs in the plane crash that claimed the lives of his friends and bandmates. Now, even though he's badly injured, he knew that he needed to go get help, and he needed to get it, like, immediately. So he manages, even though it hurt like hell, I'm sure, he manages to find a farmhouse. He throws himself over the barbed wire fence, injuring himself more in the process. And it took almost an hour from him to travel from the crash site to the farmhouse. That must have felt like an eternity. Artemis shares that the farmer thought he was a trespasser and actually shoots at him. The farmer would later decline this. Pyle says this.
I know the farmer was only protecting his family. He came out of the house, and I looked like Charles Manson, all covered in blood with my long hair and beard. He yelled, stop. I saw the gun. I was stumbling because I had injuries, and I thought I was dying. Then something tore through my arm, and I yelled, plane crash. With what I thought was my last breath.
Artemis Pyle was interviewed by Forbes and shares a lot of disturbing details about that fatal day.
We landed in Mississippi pine trees 3 feet thick. It tore the plane completely apart in the 10 to 12 seconds it took to go from 200 miles to a dead stop.
He shared that while in Tokyo, Ronnie Van Sant confided in him, telling him that he knew he was going to die young. He would not live to see 30 years. And he was very right. He was 29 years old when he died that day. And here's even more a haunting image as it gets a lot more detailed from Artemis Pyle.
Every second a drop of blood drips out is a step closer to death. I started putting one foot in front of the other. I found the pilot, co-pilot. One was decapitated, and one was hanging in a tree. Body parts. It was just flesh and blood to me, because their souls and spirits had already come out of those bodies.
Intense. I mean, like, brutally intense. Pyle, he suffered from survivor's guilt for well over 4 decades. Bless his soul. And that's so heartbreaking to me. He said that there was no therapy that was offered to them like there probably would be today, nor did they really seek it. They just kind of drowned themselves in hardcore drugs and tons of alcohol. He blames the drugs and booze for his former bandmates who died after the crash.
It eventually killed a lot of my friends. Leon, Billy, and Alan. Every one of them could have lived a longer life had we gotten proper therapy.
This is what the National Transportation Safety Board accident report said. Quote, the National Transportation Safety Board determined that the probable cause of this accident was fuel exhaustion and total loss of power from both engines due to crew inattention to fuel supply. Contributing to the fuel exhaustion were inadequate flight planning and an engine malfunction of undetermined nature in the right engine that resulted in torching and higher than normal fuel consumption, unquote. The year before the plane crash, Aerosmith was wanting to use this aircraft for their tour, but they refused the aircraft after they weren't happy with the inspection. Also, they couldn't help but notice that Captain McCreary and First Officer Gray were drinking a Jack Daniels, just kind of passing it back and forth, passing that bottle back and forth, back and forth. Which is fine. I drink too. It's fine if you're not going to navigate in the friendly skies. The following year, those two gentlemen would be among the dead in the ever-so-fatal plane crash. A plane crash that broke up the original Lynyrd Skynyrd. And I have no clue if there was alcohol involved in this. There may have not been. But what I do know is that there were several fatal errors on these two men's part. And that several people, including themselves, would be alive today if things maybe have gone a hell of a lot differently. And another eerie thing I should mention is that the album that was released 3 days, mind you, before they died, titled The Street Survivors, the cover of the album had the band standing there surrounded by flames. Considering what had just taken place, the MCA replaces it with a black background instead. Music is forever. Music should grow and mature with you, following you right on up until you die. Paul Simon. Big shout out to my voiceover family. Jerry Cooper is Chicago's Lee Lunane, and Steven Van Zandt from Leonard Skinner. Casey Morrow is Wendy Orlean Williams. Thomas James is Captain Walter McCreary. And Sean Curtis is Artemis Pyle from Leonard Skinner. Another big shout out to my musical family. Thank you so much for lending me your amazing tunes, Alien Manor, Stick the Landing, and Liar's Handshake. Did you like the tunes you heard? You can find further information about them in the episode description. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They are all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single one yet? No need to fret. You do not need to lose sleep over this, my friends. You could binge listen to your heart's fright and delight right now by hitting up any of those awesome podcast platforms, such as Podcast Republic, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Deezer, Spotify. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone, and I will
see you next week.